Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the 11th night and I have actually five streams tonight. I'll just tell you what those are going to be. In 2 hours from now, it'll be Pox Populi, then Jared Taylor, and then an hour after that, Robin Riley, and then an hour after her, Black Pilled. So it's going to be a very packed night. But first of all, I have the traditional Britain group here, or two representatives of it. So welcome back. I think this is definitely not your first time on Millennial, but well, thank you for agreeing to appear. You're much requested each year, so I'm grateful.
Well, we're always delighted. I think you do a wonderful job bringing on all these dissidents from around the world and from this country who are providing an alternative view, but a view that, had we expressed it 50 years ago, would have been just part of ordinary conversation. I forget whether it was Orwell, but said that in a time of revolutionary crisis, or in a time of revolution, telling the truth becomes a crime. And that's what it's become today. And these sources of alternative media are becoming increasingly important so that people can hear alternative views and alternative news because of the censorship that's going on in the traditional media, which, as we all know, is fake news to one degree or to another. So I think you're doing a fantastic job, and you're putting in a hell of a lot of effort into this by bringing together all of these people who share similar opinions and, for the most part, I dare say, are reading from the same news sheet.
Well, it's definitely that we see this similar problems in society. People have different ideas about them, different ideas for solutions, but certainly we are united by our common objection to many of the same maladies. Gregory, welcome back to Millennial. Is there anything you would like to say about the rise of the alternative media?
Well, I'm all in favour. Totally in favour of freedom of the press, freedom of the media, and I'm very much in favour of the alternative media for the simple reason that we are now faced with all the mainstream media being in the hands of the left. Now, I know when you speak to the left, they say, oh no, it's all in the hands of those evil Tories. Well, there's no Tories anymore, apart from me. And the media is quite clearly in the hands of the left, and you can gather that by the never-ending attacks on the right and all this garbage about right-wing terrorists and so on. Of course, the only terrorist that we ever hear about or ever see, and certainly the only terrorists who ever murder hundreds of people rather than the odd one, are all left-wing or Islamic. And so this is just baloney, and it demonstrates how completely biased and out of touch the mainstream media are. And so we're you know, it's really important that there's alternative media. People are crying out for it. People want an alternative view to what they're being fed. And it's very sad that our society has been taken over really by Marxists, because Karl Marx said that before they can build the new society, they have to destroy the old one. And of course, they tried that in Russia. Now, here it's been more drip feed than revolution, but drip feed it is. And most of the social norms today, which are promulgated by the government, by a fake conservative government, and by the media, wouldn't have been given the time of day in, say, 1960 or 1970, and certainly before 1940. If you read what conservatives were saying before 1940 and what they say now, they're unrecognizable. They're unrecognizable. And so the alternative media is the only way for people to access normality, to get off this Marxist deconstruction of society agenda. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the deconstruction of our society, deconstruction of normality. And it is not normal to pander to people like that ghastly woman who insulted Lady Hussey at the palace. And it is not normal to have every single ad on the television and in the newspapers full of Negroes and Asiatics and so on. When we are an overwhelmingly majority Caucasian European country, we still are, and therefore, that's what we should be seeing. We should be seeing a proper representation of our people in all things. In all things, people should not be getting jobs just because they're a Negro or just because they're an Asiatic. And we have seen this Conservative Party completely cave in to this positive discrimination agenda. They have, in fact, not just the Conservative Party, but everybody at Westminster. Everybody at Westminster has caved into this positive discrimination agenda. People are given positions because they're aliens, or they've been given positions because they're women. And we are living in a very, very, very sick society today. And they're trying to push it.
Sorry, I think Andrew is waiting to chime in on this.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
No, very much. I agree with him. There's no. Not a word you've said with which I disagree. But let's not forget that all of this is going on under a Conservative government.
Yes. Now,
you could understand it if this was Labour, if you did not know what has really gripped the Conservative Party by the hair of its head. However, it's a Conservative Party that is doing this. All these changes are occurring under a Conservative Party. And this brings me to the point that this isn't a true Conservative Party. It's a Conservative Party of red revolutionaries, of clone members of Parliament. We've got, in effect, a criminal revolutionary government of occupation, absolutely dedicated to smashing all forms of civilized conduct in this society, civilized tradition, culture, and identity, and extirpating the British nation. That is the Conservative Party today. It's the most deceitful, treacherous organization in the history of this country. Now, it never used to be, but that has been the situation over the last 70 years or so, with a few very notable exceptions that we all know, such as Sir Andrew Bell, Enoch Powell, and others of that caliber. But for the great majority, including even the councillors, now, some of them are still traditionalists, but they're all part of this pecking order. They all want to be promoted. They don't give a damn about our society and about our nation state. So there's nothing really now to differ between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. You're just getting a different colour and you're voting for a different colour on the ballot paper. And that's where we are now. And I, for those people who feel they've got to vote, well, it's better to put a blank slip into the box or to write an appropriate comment on the ballot paper, because by voting for these people, you're just giving them more credibility.
Hello?
Sorry. So, Gregory, what would you say about the Conservative Party and the... You know, there are some people who think the Conservative Party has to be destroyed, it has to end, so that a fitting party can take its place. What would you say about that?
Well, you know, it's patently obvious to anybody but a lunatic that the Conservative Party is only conservative. The only conservative thing about it is its title. And they have adopted the agenda of the left. In economics, their agenda is Manchester liberalism. In social politics, their agenda is no different to the socialists and the liberals. So they are really just a Mark II liberal party. And I think Andrew's absolutely correct in what he says, that people should not vote for these, for any of them. If there's no one else to vote for, just don't vote. But unfortunately, because of tribal voting, people just go in and say, oh, we've got to keep the other people out, without even thinking that they're not going to get anything different. They're getting the same thing. You know, it doesn't matter who they vote for. They're getting the same thing. There won't be any change. We have a completely out of control welfare system, which is just as out of control under the Conservative Party as it is under the Labour, as it would be under the Labour Party if we had a Labour Party government. So there's just no change. Well, you know, I constantly ask people. I've got friends say, "Oh yes, I couldn't vote for anybody else other than the Conservative Party." And I say, "Why? Why do you vote for the Conservative Party? What have they conserved since, say, 1960? Tell me what they've conserved. What do you see as a great milestone in traditional conservatism?" And they say, "Oh, well, the Conservative Party's always been a bit liberal." No, it hasn't. That's just a fallacy. That's just what they want to believe. The Conservative Party started off as the complete opposition to liberalism. And right up until the Second World War, the liberals were the enemy just as much as the socialists. And before the socialists ever appeared in British politics, the Liberal Party was the enemy to conservatives. It was a battle between those two. And so now there's no battle. They're all on the left, all of them. And the only way this can ever be changed is if we adopt proportional representation, which will give other small parties the opportunity. At the moment, everyone knows that when you vote for the small party, you're not going anywhere. We saw what happened to UKIP. They got 4 million votes. They got one seat. An absolute disgrace. A monster disgrace. And it's completely hopeless at the moment. We're never, ever going to break out of this deadlock at Westminster unless we get proportional representation. Everybody was cheering when Marine Le Pen came second in the presidential race. Everybody was cheering when the AfD in Germany got 80 or 90 seats in the parliament. Everybody was cheering when the new Italian prime minister,
Giorgia Meloni,
yes, when she came into office. Everyone was cheering. Isn't this great? It's a victory for reality, a victory for normality. And what they forgot is that these people only got in the very first instance because there was a freedom to vote them in. There was a proper electoral system, proportional representation, which gave these people the opportunity to put their heads above the parapet. That does not exist in Great Britain. It does not exist.
I guess so, the problem is that neither the Tories nor Labour have any incentive to bring in proportional representation, because it would disadvantage them. It would end their endless, I don't know what you would say, to and fro charade that they've got going on, and that they've had going on for a long time, like 100 years now.
Yeah, so, but the joke is that when you speak to these people, they say, "Oh, well, we'd end up with endless coalition governments, endless coalition governments." That's what we've got now. We've got an endless coalition government. We have Labour, the Conservatives, and a few of the others sprinkled about, those crazy Greens and various other people. This is a coalition parliament.
Well,
and that's all we've ever had in my lifetime.
But it's a coalition in a more subtle sense, which is that there is nothing to choose between Labour and Conservative at this point. And that, maybe Andrew would have something to say about this. Why is that? I mean, what is it that's happened in British politics? And I dare say it's not just Britain, that has meant that the two parties are just the same, really?
Well, I think the two parties have been taken over to various degrees. Now, I had a dinner fairly recently with some elected members from various parliaments on the continent. And at that dinner, there was a Conservative MP. Now, I won't give his name, but he was there. And we were discussing this sort of thing. And I said to him, I said, is it not a fact that the Conservative Party is in the condition it is because Mrs. Thatcher failed to sort out the selection process? It's the selection process that brings in a clone type MP that is not going to stray beyond the parameters in which he's allowed to operate. He's not going to raise issues such as immigration, such as the World Economic Forum, and so on, globalism, and so on and so forth. He's going to keep it all neat and tidy so there isn't a problem. And that is, and I said, that surely is the biggest failure of Mrs. Thatcher. And he said, yes. Go on, Gregory.
Gregory.
Now, Mrs. Thatcher did that. It was under her. What you used to be able to do, if you heard of a vacancy and you wanted to go into Parliament, you went along to the constituency chairman and you said, well, I understand there's a vacancy coming up here, or there is a vacancy here, and I'd like to be your MP. And they would say, well, come along to the next meeting on such and such a date, such and such a time, and we'll interview you. And then if they decided they wanted you, they would select you, and they would advise Westminster that they had done this. Now, Thatcher said, we're not having that, Thatcher and her liberal advisers. And Thatcher was a liberal. Don't make any mistake about that. And what happened then was they set up an approved candidates list at central office. And this meant that nobody would go on to this list unless they were approved by central office. And then, if you had a vacancy at constituency level, the constituency office would then contact central office, and central office would say, well, we've got three or four people, we'll send them to you. And then, so you had a choice. You had a choice between three liberals that had been selected by central office, and so it wouldn't have mattered which one you chose because they'd all been approved. It's like Stalinism. It's like when the Soviet Union had elections, there'd be three or four candidates you could vote for, but they were all communists.
Yeah, this is the thing about parachuting into a seat. Andrew?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yes, you're absolutely right. And we had this conversation with this MP, and he said, we didn't go into the depths of this and so on, but he said that it should have been sorted out. Mrs. Thatcher did the very opposite. Central office ended up with ultimate control over who could be an MP or not. And so the ordinary people weren't represented. In fact, the constituents weren't represented any longer. Not even the members of the local Conservative Party were represented. And it was all a question of receiving approval from the central office. And that's why the Conservative Party, and to a different degree the Labour Party, is in the mess it is. It's becoming increasingly unrepresentative of the British people, and that's why it's got itself, to answer your question, into the position that it has. It's exactly the same, although to a varying extent, in America, where they've got this two-party system. Well, on the continent, they have proportional representation. And there's all sorts of different types, types in Italy, Germany, and so on and so forth. But it means that good, ordinary people can get elected, and that provides the official stamp of approval of recognised parliament, and it then attracts more and more people. Now, when I've been to events in the Freedom Party in Austria, it's full of lawyers, doctors, dentists. There's a brain surgeon I know over there, and they're all respectful members of society, the sort of people you'd go to if you're in difficulty, a lawyer perhaps, or a brain surgeon if you've got terminal cancer or something like that in the brain. And they've got these sort of people, but people over here are frightened. And this fear is preventing a lot of people I know, and I mix in circles where I hear what people are thinking, and they're not different from the sort of discussions we're having here, but they dare not raise this because we don't have free speech here anymore, and they will lose their jobs. That's what happened, of course, to the doctors with the vaccines. They were all frightened of being dismissed by the NHS or whoever it is they work for. But I think that answers your question.
Well, that brings us to the matter of the World Economic Forum, because I know this was something you wanted to raise. Hold on a second. I'll just get the focusing right on this. Andrew, I mean, it seems to me that this is part of why the parties have become so identical, that there is nothing to choose between them. It's because some other power has, global powers have formed, materialized at some point, I guess, after World War II or maybe before then even, and are now really dominating the political situation in each country in the West. What would you say about that? Andrew first.
Yes. Well, if you go back, say, 40 years ago, back to the 1980s, perhaps a bit later, perhaps a bit earlier, it was customary to talk about Reds under the bed. By that, they were talking about infiltrators in the Labour Party, in the trade union movement, and shop stewards and so on. But we've got a far more serious situation today. And it's not just Reds under the bed. These Reds are in the bed. In fact, there are so many Reds in the bed that we can't see who's doing what to whom. I don't want to get into the entrails of conspiracy and conspiracy theories, but let's see what Klaus Schwab and the WEF has said about itself. And that Bond villain figure, a few months ago, you can find it on the internet, he was talking about how the WEF had penetrated cabinets. Now, he was referring to Canada in particular, but if you look at the various prime ministers of Europe, and I think I'm right in saying that variously, Macron, Rutte from the Netherlands, Merkel from Germany, there's a whole batch of others, were all at one time young WEF leaders. And suddenly they've got the position of leading their countries. Now, that's clearly what Schwab was talking about when he said that they had managed to penetrate cabinets. And it demonstrates that there is a global force that has a sway in this country. And we saw that during the COVID and the lockdowns and so on. So if you go to the WEF and find out what it is they're talking about, then it's just a matter of time before much of this becomes introduced into the various nation states, which aren't run for the benefit of the people any longer. They're run for these international organizations, multinational corporations, the international media, global designs of various stripes and hues. One of the things we might talk about today is where we were last year. Well, we've moved from the vaccine. Well, the vaccines are still very much going on, but we've moved into the financial plight that follows the lockdowns, and Britain has added something like $500 billion of debt since 2020. And it's a vast amount. Had Corbyn got in, and everyone was frightened to death that he would get in, his spending plans were relatively modest. So we've got this budget now, which was an austerity budget, with taxes hiked up to degrees we've never seen before here. in order to pay for this. And we've got another part where we're the population is suffering enormously, and that comes from this Ukraine war. People don't know the backdrop to this. Just chuck out one figure. I can go on at this. I could spend 20 minutes talking about the backdrop to this quite easily. But how many people know that from 2014 onwards, the Ukraine has been shelling its eastern provinces? Now, if Northern Ireland was being shelled by Dublin, then the Ulstermen would be very angry about this, and eventually they'd take action. Well, this has been going on for 6 years. I mean, it's hardly surprising that eventually the Russian bear, being prodded and so on, reacted. Now, I'm not a fan of Putin, but I'm not a fan of Zelensky either. And he's banned his opposition. He's shut down media stations that are critical of him. He hasn't carried out his manifesto promises. I mean, he's every bit as bad as Putin and worse. But the point of this sanction regime is that we're committing sanctions against ourselves. There's now a shortage of fertilizer. We can't get all sorts of commodities out of Ukraine. So what's going to happen? Well, oil prices are already higher, and that's what happens if you move 5 million barrels of Russian oil from Western markets per day. So we've got much higher oil prices. That means higher diesel prices. That means higher agricultural prices. And without any fertilizer, you've got even higher agricultural prices because you can't produce enough foodstuffs. So we've got all that to look forward to. That hasn't yet reached its apex. And at the same time, amazingly, this regime, this WEF regime, and in the interests of so-called climate change, we can get on to that as well. Another nonsense.
Before we get on to that, I'd like to bring Gregory back in, because you've actually covered and traversed a huge number of topics there, which is it's fine. But I want to make sure Gregory gets his say on these things, because they're very important topics. Gregory, what would you have to say? Do you subscribe to this? I do. I'll be open about it. I agree with Andrew that there are global powers in charge of the political situation, as I said, and they dominate now. And it's the media, it's the high finance, it's global institutions like the UN and all that. And this is stuff that I think conservatives didn't really talk about. As far as I know, I was following conservative media for a long time, really from about 2005 onwards. And only after COVID did we really catch up with all of this stuff, I think. I think that we didn't realize how, or certainly I didn't realize how important all of this is. The UN, the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization. What would you say about this stuff?
What conservative media were you following? Something I don't know about. I think that I'm really not a conspiracy theorist. But I think the reality of the situation is, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, and that is that liberalism is as much an international ethos as is socialism. The socialists and the communists believe in internationalism because it's a cornerstone of Marxism. The liberals believe in it for money. So they both believe in internationalism, but for different reasons. And one of the cornerstones of liberalism is free trade. And so after the Second World War, by stages, they dismantled all the protectionism that we had before the war. Because the conservatives used to believe 100% in protectionism. Once you do that, you open up the purchase in your country by foreigners of fundamental industries, and they don't have a nationalist perspective. They don't care about Britain. They only care about money. That's what it's all about. And that is the greatest failing of the Conservative Party, that they have allowed international companies to come in and buy all of our industries and ultimately to close them all down. They have allowed people like Dyson to close his factory here where he made his fortune and move it to Poland just to save a few, or the Czech Republic or somewhere, just to save a few pennies on the wages. Well, sorry, but, you know, that's liberalism. And if people can't grasp what's going on, I feel very sorry for them. For me, it's staring me in the face. So, as I said, unless you get a change in government, it's going to continue, because I think corruption is a natural thing, and I think every country has it, and I don't think Britain's any different. And the you know, there's reasons people have voted for free trade, and it's because they're getting backhanders. And we see what's happened. Even Cadbury's, the great British institution, Cadbury's, has been bought by the Americans, and our Cadbury's factory, the biggest chocolate factory in Great Britain, was closed. And nobody seems to care about these things. You know, when I go on and on about it at a dinner party, everyone's like, "Oh, Gregory is such an extremist," you know, and they can't seem to grasp the simple salient facts.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the example of Cadbury's because that's such a sad one. It's so, it sort of touches people, I think, that it was something that mattered to the British people, something that was close to us. And so it's very sad.
But the Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, people say, "Oh, the Encyclopedia Britannica, this is a great British institution." And I keep saying to them, "No, it's not. It's owned by foreigners, and it's published in Chicago. It's nothing to do with Britain. They should change the name."
Yeah, and of course, it's the same with all the football clubs as well. It's terrible. But I think Andrew's waiting to chime in here. So,
Gregory, you're absolutely right, and it's a very good point you make. And let's name a few of these other large British industrial leaders, which all went under Labour and Conservative governments. We lost P&O, that was taken over. Hanson Industries, taken over. ICI, wonderful British bellwether. Pilkington Glass, right at the cutting edge of glass innovation and so on. Cadbury's, you just mentioned, they closed the factory down. BOC, I think it was originally known as the British Oxygen Company, now owned by a German conglomerate. Linda, I think it is. Now, all of these corporations, the point is, it's not just a matter of closing them down here. When you relocate them to the home country of the takeover company, then you lose the essential office of research and development. That is absolutely essential. So that goes with it. So you've lost the research entity that's a part of those industrial companies. Also, you lose the component manufacturers. Why should those foreign companies buy their components from here? Well, they don't. They end up buying them from Germany or from France or from Spain or America or wherever else it is. So you lose that too. And with that, you lose all the service, the ancillary service industry, the professionals, the lawyers, the accountants, that sort of backup, which every company and corporation needs. And it's not just that, but we're also losing our inventions. Now, heaven knows, but something like 50% of the world's inventions have come from this country, from Britain, this tiny little island with an enormous inventive and innovative power. And these inventions get snaffled up as well by overseas corporations. It's very often the Americans. I mean, heavens above, when you think about all the inventions that the internet was that came from here, but you know, the jet engine, our industrial revolution about 150 years ahead of, certainly 100 years ahead of our competitors and so on. And all of these things get hoovered up, and we're ending up as a service industry. Our industry has been hollowed out, but we can't carry on indefinitely servicing money as a sort of tourist industry full of estate agents. We need to have an essential industry as a backbone, and we're losing that, and we're losing the skills. And once the skills go, you can't easily replace them. They take generations properly to replace.
And another aspect of this is that mass immigration also seems to happen partly because everything is about money. And I don't think it's the only reason it happens. I think that the left have ideological reasons for diversity and, frankly, replacing white people. But the right have ruthless monetary reasons for wanting mass immigration.
They're not the right, they're the liberals.
Well, yeah.
You need to get that right. They're the liberals. The right are the old pre-1940 conservatives. They're the right. The rest of them are all on the left.
Yes. The trouble is, immigration does two things. It breaks down in increments the nation state, and that's part of a global design. And it does something else too. It compresses the going rate. It compresses wages. And the British worker suddenly finds that, as he is at the moment, with very high inflation, wages well-trailing inflation, then his standard of living is falling. And what did the Conservative government do this last year? What did it do? Well, the figures came out the other day. I'm sure they tried to suppress them. But there were 505,000 migrants that came into this country up until June 2022. This is under a Conservative government which has promised time and again to reduce immigration down to the tens of thousands. Theresa May said she was going to do it. She didn't. They've all been, each time there's a general election, they get their union flag out, they dust it down, they fly it around, wave it around under the guise of the people, they hypnotize them and get them to vote for them. That's all it is. And then when they get in, they have absolutely no intention of doing it. This is a concerted plan deliberately to destroy the nation state, to destroy our culture, our identity, our way of life, our history. And heavens above, it's permeated every single aspect of our lives now. They've got decolonizing curriculums in the universities, in the schools, and even the National Health Service. They've got all these diversity advertisements going on all the time. I mean, you can find them in The Guardian. I've seen some of them. Gregory, I think you put them on the TBG site. You sent some of these to me. But the cost to the taxpayer of these diversity programs is enormous. And what does diversity mean? Well, it's not cohesiveness. It's the very reverse of cohesiveness. It splinters and fractures society. And we're ending up in a sort of Tower of Babel, where there are no common standards, no common morality, values, no common religion, no common social mores. And all of these things are being stripped piecemeal to the extent now that, as I said earlier on before we went on air, any Briton born in the last 30 to 40 years has never experienced proper freedom in this country. He doesn't know what it's like to be a free person anymore. It's been stripped and stolen from him without any consultation or consent whatsoever by all the usual criminal politicians and conservative parties.
Oh, yeah. This is a terrible thing. And I think that, as we were saying before we went on air, young people probably don't realize that Britain actually was it wasn't always diverse. Britain actually was a white country once. And now it still is a majority of white country. But the thing is, with the media, again, we were saying, black people are, I think, about 3% of the British population. But if you were 4%. But if you were going by the media, if you were going by the representations on TV, you would think that they were 50%. Or even more.
Imagine that Negroes in particular constitute just 4 people in every 100. 4 people. So every time you see a Negro in an ad, they have rejected the 97 or 98 people, other people, and they've rejected all of our people, every single one of them, in favor of the black man. Now, why is that? Well, what is wrong with these people? Why do they do this? And it's because the advertising agencies are multinational, they're international, and they're selling products all over the world. So when I speak to people in Europe, they say, oh, yes, our ads are all like that as well. In Germany, in France, yes, exactly the same. Because of these internationalist companies who are pushing internationalism constantly, as much as any good socialist, and it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. And what is wrong here is that we have nobody fighting back. Just small groups like the traditional Britain group speaking out and saying, this is wrong. Everyone must see this is wrong. I speak to people who regard themselves as conservatives and they say, every ad's full of blacks. Have you ever noticed that? I said, yeah. What have you done about it? Did you write to your MP? And they say, oh, it's just a waste of time.
Well, that's the issue. Yeah. What can MPs do about this?
Well, they
because that would be racist. So, you know.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote to my MP about it. And he said, I don't agree with you. I wrote back to him and I said, well, it's not for you to agree with me. It is for you to take this matter up with the minister because that's what I asked you to do. And he wrote back and said, well, I'm not going to do that. So much for democracy, eh? Democracy's working well.
Mm. Andrew wants to chime in here.
Yes. And it's not just advertising. You're absolutely right about advertising, but it's permeated almost every aspect of society. Exactly, yeah. As the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory wished to do back in the 1920s. They wanted to break down every single institution of the West, especially Christianity. Well, they've done that, but it's permeated the schools. Well. Some made some comment, I don't know whether it was a Jesuit, give me a child when he's five and I've got him for life. Well, that's what they're up to in the schools now. Education has become a sort of propaganda system for those people who hate our country, hate our civilization, who hate everything that characterizes the West. And let's make this absolutely clear, because I don't think I've ever met any racists on the right. I mean, okay, they exist. We all know they exist out in the far reaches on the periphery. We have nothing to do with them. I have never had any difficulties with people of different backgrounds. I respect their origins the same as they do mine. But the point is, the real racists will make this absolutely clear. The real racists are to be found amongst our own kind because they quite literally hate our own kind and want to extirpate us, and indeed themselves. And this is a sort of perverted mentality. It doesn't happen anywhere in the animal kingdom, but it does happen here. And I'm afraid I can't understand that. I can understand that some people would do it for 30 pieces of silver, and there are those like that. There are those who want to do it because they will get some media attention. But for the rest of them, I really am at pains to try to discover why they would want to destroy their own kind, their own history, their own heritage, for which their ancestors at some point doubtless fought.
Well, I think part of it is that they've been led to believe that they don't have a people and that ancestry doesn't matter. I mean, the whole thing with Cheddar Man, for example, I think has been just invaluable for the left because it enables them to disingenuously discredit the idea of a peoplehood, especially within Britain. I mean, you know, I saw a thing just today, three leftists, bringing it up, and they think it's a killer argument that, we all came from Africa. Well, it was a very long time ago, and that matters.
That's been demolished by numerous studies. So The trouble is they're just doing a bit of selective reading, I think. And the thing is that I had my paternal DNA done, and it showed that we had been in Devon for 5,000 years. So that, I would have thought that makes you sort of indigenous white European, no? 5,000.
You would hope so.
you think that rather stands for something. It stands for much more than someone who's arrived here and got citizenship like you buy a pound of butter in the shop. And that's where it's all wrong. Civic citizenship, that's another thing that needs to be abolished. We need people should only be able to become citizens in this country if they can demonstrate British ancestry. And that doesn't mean British ancestry to a slave or to somebody else that's been carted in. It's got to mean our people, European people. And people say to me, oh, you know, this is a hate crime. It's a hate crime because you hate foreigners and you hate aliens. You're xenophobic. And I keep pointing out to them, I don't hate these people at all. These people have a natural homeland. And that's where they should be. They shouldn't be in ours. And how simple is that? How is that something that people cannot grasp? Why does that have to be a hate crime?
And the thing is, everyone up until 50 years ago, maybe longer, 70 years ago, everyone would have agreed with you on that. Everyone in Britain would have agreed. It would be effortlessly obvious that, of course, I mean, Lars, you know, you're always going to get the odd one who somehow arrives here. It doesn't matter. It's just one person. Millions of them. Or even thousands, or even hundreds of them. That's a completely different thing. Yeah. And they... No, they don't belong here, and that is, and everyone knows that. And that's the fact that the only way they can belong here is by radically changing this country. And
that's what they're about.
Yeah,
and our government's assisting this because our government's saying if you offend any of these people, we're going to have you in court.
Yeah.
So basically. When I was growing up, people walked around saying, I hate the French, I hate foreigners, or I hate Roman Catholics, or I hate this, or I hate that. And that was all, you know, people just said, oh, well, there we are. Joe Blow doesn't like Catholics. He doesn't like the French. But now you can't say these things. They say you're a racist, there's a hate crime, blah, 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 blah. Everyone should have the right to say what they don't want and what they dislike, and no government has the right to say to our people, you must like these people who have flooded in to your country. They have no right to say that. They can say you can't beat these people up and you must treat them properly under employment law. Yes, that's fine, but they have no right to be telling us who we must like and, you know, and how we should go about it and what we must say and what we cannot say, because that's what Stalin did.
Yeah. I remember seeing a quote that 100 years ago an Englishman could go through, and no doubt a Scotsman as well, could go through his whole life and never notice the existence of the British state, but for the local post office, and that would be the extent of it. As long as he paid his taxes, that would be it. He might never ever need to interact with the British state, and certainly not be shaped by it and programmed by it. And this is a sad reflection,
which is what they're doing in the schools. That they're brainwashing the children from a very early age with this multicultural agenda, despite many politicians such as Merkel and even Cameron at one point saying multiculturalism is a failure. They say one thing, they do another, because they're liars and they cheat.
And,
and unless we get proportional representation and get a decent party into Parliament that believes in Britain, and believes in the British people and says, immigration's going to stop, and we're going to start encouraging repatriation with big handouts. We'll set up a land agency. We'll buy back their properties as long as they go. And that is what, yes. That's what the Conservative Party said they were going to do in 1970, and they lied. They said that in their manifesto. So they got elected in a landslide victory, and they swept it aside and said, good, we're in now. We'll forget about that. Because they're liars and cheats.
Yes, and that was a terrible thing, because that was probably the last time when this could easily have been remedied.
That could be dealt with. Yeah.
Andrew's been wanting to come in here.
Yes, the schooling today, as I said earlier, has become a sort of propaganda forum to make whites feel, our people, feel thoroughly ashamed of themselves. But it has to stop there. There's a thing called, and you can Google this, Operation Teamwork in the Army, to do exactly the same in the Army. These diversity people have managed to infiltrate every part of our institutions. Even in the Rugby Football Union, they've got them there. I wrote to them. I played rugby until about 5 or 6 years ago. I ran out of steam. And I wrote to them. I challenged them on this. I challenged them to a debate at a time and place of their choice to debate all of these things. Well, I tie them up in so many circles that they eventually stopped communicating with me. But let's go to this wonderful chap, Pierre Brochard. He was the former chief of French intelligence, and this came out earlier this year. It was in quite a number of the newspapers. It was a big story. It couldn't be hushed up. And he warned of civil war in France. And he made it very clear. He said multicultural societies are doomed. They just do not work. There is going to be civil war in France. Now, that was the head of French intelligence. That's what he was paid to do. He should have known. And I have no doubt he does know. But our people aren't prepared to speak out like that. And that is the sort of thing we have been warning about for decades, because we know the rules of history. We know what history teaches. And those who do not recognize the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. And that's what we've got coming to us. And let's look at some of the statistics that have come out of the census. And it shows that since 2017, in fact, I think I got this from the Spectator, since 2017, some 90% of the population growth has been due to immigration from generally non-EU sources. But one third of the children of this country are now to ethnic minorities.
And this is terrible. This is so bad. It's a crime that this was allowed to happen.
Yes, in 20 years' time, that will be over 50%. But to do anything more than to greet that with joy and acclaim is to be racist. There's no discussion of all of those who visited that situation on us. And it's not the immigrants themselves. It's the usual people. It's the cosmopolitans, and it's the MPs from the two main parties, plus the corner cupboard party, the Liberal Party. That's where it's all come from. Without any consultation or consent, we're going to be reduced to minority status, probably within one generation. Something else that's been stolen, in addition to free speech, something else that's been stolen, not just from this current generation, but from future generations for whom we are trustees or custodians.
Well, that so Gregory seems to have dropped out. We'll see what happens there. Something else that has completely fallen away is this notion that you just alluded to there of ourselves as custodians of the future, bequeathing something. We are only temporary custodian. We only own this temporarily. And our duty is to pass it on to our descendants. And I think that notion has been strongly discouraged in favor of a much more here and now perspective, where you don't have ancestors, you don't have descendants. Your country is just where you happen to have been born, and it can belong to anyone at all. And this is an insane situation. It destroys the idea of homeland. It destroys the idea of heritage and turns everyone into just a consumer. And a consumer who has to contend with the presence of many other people from many other backgrounds that have nothing to do with him, which would be bad enough, but except that it's even worse because those other people tend to take their backgrounds seriously. So they're, it's a weird situation.
Yes, they're allowed to express pride in their traditions and their culture, but we are not. And yet we are those population. We're not allowed to do this. It's a sort of Orwellian situation we've all entered into. Everyone knows it. Everyone understands it. They all say, well, you may think that, or you may say it privately, but you can't say it publicly.
And that's Scotland, you can't even say it privately anymore. You know, they're trying to bring in a hate speech law that would apply even to your own home. Which just seems incredible that Gregory has come back. So thank you, Gregory, for sorting out the technical problem. Oh, you're muted. Hold on. There you go.
Yes, I'm afraid the internet went down. Sorry about that. Telling you what you can say at your dinner table has to be totally Stalin-esque. Not a shadow of doubt about that. But talking about civil war is probably a bit OTT. I mean, we don't want to really encourage this sort of activity, but who knows what spontaneous combustion amongst a population will bring up. And our people, I think, are very slow. They're very slow, the Brits. They're not like the Latins. The Latins erupt at the drop of a hat. You know, the French go out and block their roads and spray manure over municipal buildings and do all kinds of things. But the Brits are a little bit more, take their time about it. But I think eventually that there will be an explosion. Enoch Powell predicted an explosion of bad feeling amongst the people, and we'll just have to wait and see how it pans out. But we don't have a party at the moment that believes in the British people. They believe totally in a totally multicultural society and a multi-ethnic and a multiracial society. Which our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents would have seen as an anathema.
Well, it'd be completely baffling to them. There's a meme that perfectly illustrates civic nationalism or multiculturalism, and I want to show it to you now. It's one that I've always thought was very apposite. Here it is. So this is from 5 years ago, and it is, as you can see, a white woman being scanned security by a Muslim woman at an airport. And the thing is, there is no way for the civic nationalist to complain about this. I mean, we all know immediately this is absurd.
It's wrong.
Yeah, yes. it's wrong and it's degrading and it's ridiculous. But there is no way for someone who's asserted a belief in civic nationalism to object to this. They have to say, well, yeah, why shouldn't a Muslim woman be scanning a white woman? It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter.
It's not as simple as that, is it? This woman is in her natural homeland. She's in her ancestral homeland, and she is being policed and scanned by an alien.
Yeah,
that's what's wrong. What's wrong. We should never, ever in our country be subject to foreigners and to aliens. We must always, always come first in our ancestral homeland. This is our country. And that's got to be first on the list for any politician that believes in our people. If they don't believe in our people and they side with the multicultural agenda, then we know where, at least where they stand. We know that these people are traitors.
Yes, yes. And the treachery of the Conservative Party in particular is, it should live in history, really. I mean, at least Labour openly betray the working class. You know, at least they're quite open about it. But the Conservatives continually pretend to care about the British people while continually betraying it. And Andrew, would you like to come in here?
Yes. Really, as a bit of an aside, you, of course, I agree with everything that's been said, but as an aside, we discussed the situation in Scotland, and you heard about my views about the Scottish National Party about 2 years ago when I was off, and how degenerate and decadent it is, and it's an enemy organisation. It hates Scotland, it hates its own culture, it hates true nationalism, it hates Scottish identity. Absolutely no question about that. But it reminded me of something that was incredibly funny. I mean, unfortunately, it was true. It was one of these weird products of the multicultural society, of the politically correct society today. You probably heard about it. This Scotsman, he was over 60. And this is not a joke. I mean, he went along. He'd been given blood for many decades. And he went along to do his duty. He went to the hospital he normally goes to. And he said, "I'm here to give my usual blood." And he was presented with his form. He had to fill it in. And it asked him, this chap's over 60, it asked him whether he was pregnant. Well, he said, "What do you mean, am I pregnant?" They said, "Well, you've got to fill the form in." He said, "For heaven's sake," he said, "I'm over 60 and I'm a male. How could I be pregnant?"
Yeah. He said,
but they insisted that he fill it in. And he said, "Well, I'm not going to fill it in. I'm not going to go through this ridiculous procedure." He got back on his bike and he cycled home. And so the NHS was one pint short of blood. But that's how bad it's got now. I mean, you know, the lunatics have taken over the asylum. And it reminds me of what Enoch Powell said in his famous speech back in 1968. He said, "Those whom the gods wish to destroy, first they make mad." And we must be literally mad to be going along with this sort of nonsense. Now, everyone knows this is madness. Some people are too fearful to speak out, but the great majority aren't prepared to put up, I would say, for this much longer. You know, the harder they tighten the lid down on that pressure cooker, eventually it's going to come off, and when it comes off, there's going to be one hell of an eruption. And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't like to be an MP when that happens. And it's not the only thing that they're going to be discussing. This vaccine thing, I don't know whether you saw the speech in the House of Commons by Andrew Bridgen the other day, who has taken apart the government narrative on this, but it's received, to the best of my knowledge, almost no coverage in the traditional media, which demonstrates the censorship that's going on. But if you Google it, I'm sure you'll find it. I presume it's still on YouTube. It's more difficult to censor that sort of thing from YouTube, but perhaps they have. But you'll find it on Rumble or one of the alternative media sites, and he's taken apart the whole narrative. And it reminds me of the person we had at the Traditional Britain Group conference this year. We had Christine Anderson, and she sits on the Health Committee of the European Parliament, and she and her colleagues had the Pfizer representative up for questioning on their committee. And that representative had to admit that there had been no tests to demonstrate that the Pfizer vaccination provided any immunity against the transfer of the disease, of the virus. So it didn't do what we were all told it to do, that it would prevent, I forget the word they used, but the
transmission
prevent
of COVID.
The infection from being passed on. Transmissibility. That's it, transmission. But we were all told at the time, take one for granny. take one for the team. It was all part of the propaganda effort, and yet there had been no testing whatsoever about that. So as these, and I read today a German report, I think from Egon, to show that the injuries from the vaccine are rising all the time, and the death rate from unusual sources, from unusual circumstances where people just suddenly drop down dead, are at an all-time high. They're far beyond what they were by a multiple of where they were pre-vaccination. Of course, that has ramifications for life insurance, so that's why that sort of thing is important for the insurance company industry. That is now beginning to become a lot more widely known. And these are some of the things that are all adding into the mix. More and more people are discovering. More and more people have access and are obtaining access to alternative media. And they're obtaining alternative views that get at the point. And this is the point, I suppose. The pressure cooker is going to explode at some stage. And it's just a question of whether the government can bring in more draconian laws to lock down the population, to curtail free speech before it does explode. Because when it does explode, I think people are going to be looking out for a reckoning.
The COVID thing does seem like a tinderbox. I mean, it depends how long this goes on for, the higher death rates. But already, I mean, it's clear something has happened. Something has gone wrong. It has not done what it was supposed to do, and it has done damage that it wasn't supposed to do. So already there's cause for outrage. And, you know, I'm certainly not advocating that people do anything crazy, but you can understand why they would be very angry. And I think a lot of people, and really far more people should be angry. I think perhaps... Either they just don't realise, or they do realise and they can't quite believe it, what was done here, the sheer recklessness of it. I'm sorry that my camera is out of focus. I don't know what's going on there, but anyway, hopefully it will settle down. Gregory, would you have anything to say about the legacy of COVID at this point?
No.
Okay. All right, well, then we'll just go to the super chats, because there are quite a few of them. So let me see. Is it time for the UK to adopt a written constitution?
No.
Okay. Why not?
French revolutionary idea, Yankee idea. We don't need all these things. We've already had too much influence from both quarters.
All right. Andrew, do you have any opinions on this?
Yeah, I think our constitution has served us very well over the years, excepting it hasn't been enforced in the last 30 or 40 years. We've got our common law. I'm not an expert in British constitution, but our Magna Carta, which led to the Declaration of Rights, which led to the British, with the Bill of Rights. We have essential protections under the law, some of which are from common law. The problem is that the Constitution was subverted when we joined the European Union, because the supremacy of the law passed to the European Union. And
I think we might have lost Andrew now. Okay, I'll just move on to the next one. Oh. Oh, you're back.
Hello.
Hello.
It looked as though everyone disappeared for a minute. I was just saying that our constitution is compromised by joining the European Union and by a number of acts that the government today introduced, such as the Labour government in 1997 when it repealed the 1795 Treason Act. Now, if you start picking the constitution piecemeal, that might not have been a constitutional law, but if you start unpicking things, then you start destabilizing the whole system. And let's not forget the position of the monarch has also been vital within the British Constitution, because the sovereignty of Parliament isn't the House of Commons. The sovereignty of Parliament is the Crown in Parliament. And that gets us into a difficult minefield about whether we should ever have joined the European Union in 1973, and I contend that we shouldn't. But we should have done it on a constitutional basis. So, to answer your correspondent's question, I think we have to enforce our constitution and take it back where it was. And we can't do that as long as we remain in the European Union, which we still do, incidentally. The sovereignty of the law hasn't returned, the supremacy of the law hasn't returned to this country. And we don't have an internal market here anymore because of the Ulster Protocol, which prevents us from trading as a country around the world. So there are all sorts of difficulties which we have to reconsider and revise to take us back to where we were pre-1973.
All right. We'll move on to the next super chat. Here we go. Mortal Kombat reference. I think I'll ignore that one. Right. Do you have anything to say about Meghan and Harry receiving a human rights award for standing up to racism and white supremacy within the British royal family? I didn't know that they had received an award. I'm not sure if he's being sarcastic, but Gregory, do you have any thoughts about the Meghan and Harry debacle?
I don't really think that I want to express my thoughts on Harry and Meghan online. I think they're a disgrace for a litany of reasons. I'm very pleased that they have gone to live in California, which is another dung heap as far as I'm concerned. And I just think that everyone should do their level best to ignore them.
Yeah, I would agree. Andrew, do you have anything to say about this?
Yes, I agree. It's probably best that I did provide only my opinions on the pair of them. But I would just like to say this, and I think the listener might find it rather interesting. A friend of mine who was at Eton with Prince, which is where Prince Harry was educated, said, whether he's right or not, I don't know, but this is what he told me. He told me that Harry had lost all his friends from the school. And another friend who served in the household division said he's also lost all his friends in the army. Now, that's what I was told. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me, and probably I'll leave it at that for fear that I'd say something similar to what Clarkson said the other day.
All right. Yeah, I know what you mean. Gregory, do you see a future for the House of Lords, or is it corrupted beyond repair?
I think there is a future for the House of Lords, but it's not the future of the Westminster House of Commons, which the Westminster House of Commons want for it. My ideal solution for the House of Lords would be to repeal Blair's 1999 legislation and to restore the hereditary peers to their house, which was established for them by the Crown, not by the rabble, by the Crown. And I think that it was a brilliant balance. Now it has been littered with hundreds of non-entities and people in there who are in there for political reasons and backhanders and God knows what else, and for just being a pain in the neck, like Dorian Lawrence. And I think there should be a moratorium on life peers for at least 30 years. The alternative, if you don't want a moratorium on life peers, is to strip all the life peers back to 2000 of their titles and kick them out. and start again. I think the House of Lords has to be completely independent of the electoral system, because the electoral system, as we know, is corrupt. But the electoral system, I mean, why do you want two elected houses? Why not three or four? Yes. I mean, the whole thing's a stupid nonsense. You end up with a situation like in America, in the Senate, where the Senate can actually block the legislation. Well, the House of Lords can't block the legislation, but it can seriously delay it, so much so that it might actually never go through. But the House of Lords have traditionally held the British interests first, the interests of the British people first, and the interests of the land and the country and the nation. That's what's crucial. They're not really interested in many of the things that are going on in the House of Commons, which are ultra-political. These people sitting in the old hereditary peerage, they seriously considered all the legislation when it came up, and if they were not happy with it, they sent it back, and they said, well, we don't agree with this, this is garbage. And I think the old system was the best system. And I think all of the things that have happened in my lifetime, not just the House of Lords, but some of the things that Andrew was talking about, they're all because of liberalism and modernizing. Remember, the liberals were the first modernizers. They came along in the late 19th century and they screwed up the tried and tested system of squirearchy, the aristocracy. And there was a very good balance, especially in local government and in county, at county level. And they screwed all this up. And then we had Lloyd George, of course, who did serious damage. And then, of course, we had Labour after the war and Blair in the 90s. And they have done irreparable damage, not just to the House of Lords, but to our constitutional scenario. And I think that's what's got to happen. I think we have to repeal the 1999 Act. And I think we also ought to repeal all the money that they get now, which the hereditaries never got. The hereditaries used to get a pittance for turning in, you know, like £50 or something. I mean, nothing. They got nothing. But they still came in, you know, like Lord Sudley went in every single day. And yeah, considering the legislation, these people come in, they sign in, they wander around the corridor so that somebody sees them, and then they leave. And they get some huge amount of money for doing that. These people are parasites. We've really got to stop this political corruption that's afflicting our country.
Yeah. May I come in?
Yes, sorry.
Yes, I did. We need to have a second chamber. We need to have a revising chamber. There are many instances where the second house, senior house, as it's known as, has revised legislation. Or better, it gets some of these people with considerable expertise. And traditionally, the House of Lords was filled of the Lords temporal, spiritual, and legal, I think I'm correct in saying. So there are a number of law lords. There were a number of spiritual lords, bishops in effect. There were a number of bishops who were there when the Church of England was what it used to be rather than what it is now, which is another left-wing front group. And of course, the great majority who were descended from noblemen going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And they were divorced from the political system and therefore they could think outside it and express their views as they thought fit without fearing the loss of the party whip. What's happened more recently is it's been filled with complete non-entities such as Prescott, ex-deputy head of the Labour Party, Lord Adonis. Complete non-entities, why should they be there? What is it that they've done that entitles them to be nobles, where they haven't to face any sort of election from constituents? I can't think of any good reason at all. The trouble is, it's a perpetuation of the establishment's political system, and it puts them in there because they've financed the Conservative Party or they've supported the Labour Party, whatever it is. But they're not representing the people, and the people have not been heard on issues such as political correctness, press censorship, the multicultural society, the loss of our identity, cosmopolitan institutions intruding into our governance. Now, I haven't heard any Lord talk about that. So it's a question of replacing it. But the trouble is, if we go back to the old system, I would like to see, the same way that you have an annual promotion to the Lords, I'd like to see an annual demotion from the Lords. We have far too many hereditary peers who just simply abandon the post, and they shouldn't have had any right to sit. On the other hand, we had some very good peers. They were descended from military men, some of them, and they were genuinely useful and helpful. If we replace it, do we go back to that old system, or do we have some sort of proportional representation to elect these people to the Lords? And do we have it on the same cycle as the general election, or do we have it on a different cycle, perhaps on a 4-year cycle instead of a 5-year cycle or something like that, which make it more independent? So I think these are things we've got to consider, but I think the time of it, argument for maintaining it as it is, just doesn't stand. I haven't heard any sensible argument to keep it as it is. It's just full of bootlickers, political bootlickers who've done nothing but harm to this country, and the sooner they're ejected, the better.
Yes, I'd certainly agree with you on that. Okay, there is another one. Oh, yeah. Could you ask the TBG about the potential of a Scottish independence referendum in 2023 and the implication of it if a yes result is reached? Gregory, would you take that one?
I don't think that it is in the interests of the Scottish people or the United Kingdom to break up the United Kingdom. I think that at the moment, the majority of the Scottish people have decisively voted against independence. And they've had a referendum. A referendum was held. And even the Scottish National Party at the time said this was going to be a once-in-a-generation referendum. I don't see why Scotland needs to be independent. They are fully integrated into the United Kingdom. I thought it was a mistake to give them the devolved assembly, just as I thought it was a mistake to give the Welsh devolved assembly. I don't see any requirement in such a tiny country as Great Britain to have all these assemblies and all these politicians and all this money flowing. It's just a scandal. I was always opposed to devolution. And, you know, in Russia, you know, it's several thousand miles of Vladivostok. In America, how far is it from Los Angeles to Washington? You know, it's ludicrous anybody in Scotland to be talking about the distance between Edinburgh and London, when you can reach there in half an hour in a plane. I mean, it's just really stupid. And I don't see, now that we're so integrated, and crucially, Scotland is largely dependent on the rest of the United Kingdom, notably England, for its revenues. That there is not enough tax raised in Scotland for the Scottish government to govern. So I think many people in Scotland who vote for the SNP have been blindly led by fictional propaganda about independence. I think it's a serious mistake, and I also think that it rouses up ignorant hatreds that date back to sort of William Wallace and all these sort of things. There's no comparison in history with 2022 and 1300. There's just no comparison whatsoever, because Scotland at that time was a feudatory of the English crown. Now, that is a fundamental difference. That is not the case today. When we joined the Union, we kept our own archaic legal system, and we have our own schools. The Scottish schools go on holidays at different times to the English schools. And it is truly ridiculous to say that there is any kind of English oppression or anything of Scots. And why is it that we live on a little tiny island? Tiny. If you look on an atlas, it's a tiny island. And you could fit it into a fraction of France. And why is it that we can't get on together? Why can't we just be one big happy family the way we were before the SNP arrived as a separatist, divisionalist organization, much like the Ukrainian lot?
Same.
I'm trying to make out that the Ukrainians are trying to make out that they're completely different to the Russians. There's a problem with complete ethnological myth. The Scots could say, yes, we are largely different to the English because we're largely, but not completely, Celtic. Not even they can't even do that in the Ukraine.
Yeah, indeed, it's a whole other thing. I don't want to get into that. Andrew, is there something you'd like to say here?
Well, actually, the DNA shows now that 69% of the English trace their blood back 10,000 years to the ancient Brits, and in Scotland's case, it's either 71 or 72%. So, without any question, quite apart from the influx of Vikings up and down the English and Scottish coast, Anglo-Saxons, and all the other things, Scotland, England, Wales, and Ulster are all bound to each other by blood. The Scottish National Party isn't a national party at all. It's an internationalist party. It's a subversive group that's a tartan bagpipe front organization that wants to, a Judas goat that wants to lead its herd into the knacker's yard. That's what it is. And let's be quite open about it. It's a militant organization that's whipping up anti-English sentiment. And there's always that sort of element that feels a little bit with a chip on its shoulder because it's sitting against the bigger neighbour. It's the same with Canada and America. Well, there's a certain element who fall for that, and another much larger element who have got absolutely fed up, sick and tired with the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, and I don't blame them for that. I mean, I'm fed up with the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, and so they've gone somewhere else. They've gone to the SNP. But on the matter of independence, I don't think, if there is a referendum next year, I don't think there will be, but if there were to be a referendum next year, then I don't think they'd win it again. But let's identify exactly what independence means. Now, it's not going to be independence at all. It's been made very clear that the SNP will take Scotland back into the European Union. Now, what then will happen? Well, let's be clear about that too, because all new entrants into the European Union have to sign up for a European Monetary Union. So they will have to attach themselves to Europe, which means they will lose their monetary and fiscal independence. Now, that also means that Sturgeon's idea that they can just run a continuing budget deficit just won't wash. It means that it's exactly the same as Greece. The European Commission will go like a toothpick through their accounts to make sure that all the massive services that they think they can afford now because London will pay them out and will subsidise them, just won't be feasible. They will cut like a scythe through melting butter the SNP's fiscal plans. So not only will there be no fiscal and monetary independence, but there will be no legislative independence either. Scotland will become a servile state to Brussels and to the European Union. So there's going to be no independence. Let's make that absolutely clear. The other point, just by way of an amusing observation, we all seem to be Scots here. I am a Scot. Gregory is a Scot. We're going back to Harry Lauder on one side of his family, but we'll find out all about Harry Lauder. If you go onto YouTube and just put in Harry Lauder and the wonderful tunes that came from that wonderful man. And of course, you are as well. And it might be worth just giving a plug for a group that's done a hell of a lot of good on a shoestring, and that's Alison McConaughey's Force for Good. Your leaders, your listeners might like to Google Force for Good. It's an anti-SNP site that's run out of Glasgow, and it puts all the case for the union. You've got everything there. You've got chapter and verses, pages and pages and pages of stuff. Each time the SNP comes up with something, Force for Good shoots it down. And so if you'd like to do some background reading, that's called Force for Good.
Okay. We've only got 5 minutes left, and there are three more questions, so I would ask you to answer them briefly if you can. Okay, Enlightened Despot says, multiculturalism isn't just a failure. It destroys any prospect of a functioning democracy, as you have newcomers who vote on the one issue of immigration. In Canada, you have conservative ethnic communities who prop up a radical leftist liberal government. Complete dysfunction. Gregory, would you like to take that one?
Well, I think when you let in to your country a whole lot of disparate groups, democracy becomes an exercise in self-interest and self-preservation. I think that very few of these groups that come into the country are, well, they can't become British, really and truly, and especially, you know, religion-wise, if they're not Christians, that immediately counts them out. And really, they don't wish to abandon their culture. So, you know, it's it does mean that democracy is going to be subject to, and we see it here. We see it here. We see it, as I said earlier, we see it with the parties saying, "Oh, we want a say in Parliament, so we've got to try and get the Indian vote. We've got to try and get the black vote. We've got to try and get this vote. We've got to try and get that vote." And so they then slot all these token people into positions to show that they're multicultural and that they're going to look after them and everything and to try and get the vote. And so it does. It screws democracy up. And it makes the average Englishman or the average British individual feel very peeved, you know, because they, you know, why should they have an Indian as their prime minister, for God's sake? I mean, that can't. Why do you think you'd get a Nigerian prime minister who's white? I mean, it's just wrong. So yes, you know, he's right. What he says.
Let's hear Andrew's side here.
Yeah, no, it won't work. It's a clash of cultures. You've got varying cultures jockeying position. You can only democracy. The word democracy comes from demos and kratos, but it's of a people, not of peoples. I don't know of a single successful multicultural society. They all have divisions or strains of one sort or another, and many great civilizations have fallen because they've become multicultural, not as a result of being multicultural. Japanese understand this very well, and that's why they've forbidden immigration and a multicultural society to develop there. And they've been quite open about it. They've pointed the finger at what goes on in New York and elsewhere. And it leads to criminality, divisiveness. Diversity leads to a lack of cohesion, not more cohesion. So there you are in a nutshell.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay, does the panel think there is a democratic option out of this? If not, is our best tactic to just wait for a collapse brought about by incompetence and then try to rebuild from there? Do you think the best thing to do is build communities and networks? This is rather a complex question there. Gregory, what would you say to that? Can this be fixed with the current democratic system?
No, I don't think it can. And I think that's what I said earlier, is the only way we can fix this democratically is by changing the electoral system and making it proportional so that the majority of votes cast actually count. They actually mean something. So that the majority of the population of the country feels that an election has actually represents them. You know, very few people who have cast a vote have lost out. Here, there's a whole swathe of constituencies under our existing law where there are more people that voted against the winning candidate than voted for him. I mean, the whole system is wrong. And that is why we need proportional representation. Proportional representation will give our people a chance of proper representation. That's the only way forward, in my view.
Okay, Andrew.
Well, let's be very clear. I mean, I believe in the democratic system. I'm a Democrat. I believe in freedom of speech, but we're beginning to lose our freedom of speech here. We've got an enormous hurdle to climb. We're pitched against the mass media, the globalist media, who's made it very clear that they're not prepared to entertain ideas of patriotism, of the nation state, which they want to extirpate. So whilst I'm a Democrat, we've got to understand what we're up against. And we have to go into this battle, which it is. It's a political battle with our eyes widely open. It's going to be very, very difficult. But I think somewhere in Europe, the people in exasperation will elect a patriotic party. It looks close in France now. And there may still be time. And once that happens, I think it's going to open up floodgates elsewhere. Others will get the same idea. And I think there's still hope. Let's not forget also that the internet has done us a huge service, despite all the censorship from YouTube and various other, Facebook and elsewhere. We've still got this ability to obtain our news now from agencies outside of the old traditional media, which are all collapsing in terms of their circulation figures. Whoever you look at, the Times or the Telegraph, they're all going down. So people are looking for alternative media now, and a lot of them are coming to us, especially as a result of all the upheaval and abrupt disruption over the last 3 years.
Okay. And then the final question is, what is the biggest change in 2022 from previous years? For me, it's the escalation of migrant arrivals, both on boats, but also the way they so openly house them in 4- and 5-star hotels. It's just so open that they want demographic change by any means necessary. I would agree with this. I mean, I don't think it's happening by accident. I don't think it's incompetence either. I think this is a deliberate program to replace the native British population. Gregory, would you take that?
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't know of any plan or information to that effect. But these people should not be here. And it is incumbent upon our government to look after our people and to send these people back to whence they came. They came from France. I'd send them back to France tomorrow morning. There'd be no appeal. There should be no appeal for these people. They should have no legal aid. Why should they have legal aid on the back of the British taxpayer? Why should they have all these translators costing us billions of pounds every year? All these people should be returned whence they came. Millions of them? Fine. Return them. The precedent was set by the Soviets, the people that the British and the Americans were in bed with, the Soviets. They displaced 17 million people from their actual ancestral homelands, and they shunted them into West Germany. It's been done in our lifetime, well, at least in mine. and we should not be accepting these people into the country, and we shouldn't be housing them. And they should be going into camps. All these people complaining about them being in army camps. Of course, where do they? What do they think this is? Some sort of great big gravy train. And it's an outrage. It's beyond an outrage. And they should be turned straight around and sent straight back. I'd send them back in 25 miles to Calais. I'd send them back in these great big military landing barges. I'd load them up to the hilt. And they could land on the French beach that they came from. And we should have people there with rubber bullets making sure they get out.
All right. Andrew?
Yes. I think your correspondent's right. I think it's probably the leading point of 2022. And as I said earlier on, 505,000 have come in. And this is a deliberate program. There's absolutely no question about this, of displacement and replacement. And whether or not you believe in conspiracy, that's exactly where it's going. It's been done without any consultation or consent whatsoever. And let's be clear on this. It's costing us between 2 and 3 billion a year to put these people up in hotels. That has come out in the popular press. We've got ex-servicemen who are homeless in British cities. They haven't got the ability to stay in 3, 4, 5-star hotels. But these migrants who have no connection with this country whatsoever, coming in and immediately availing themselves of taxpayers' money. It's not the taxpayers who approve, it's the Conservative Party. It's the Conservative Party MPs who are permitting this nonsense to occur, while our own people are having to go to food banks, are suffering food poverty, fuel poverty because of the Ukrainian war, and the sanctions we've committed against ourselves. And it's unjust and unfair, and the British people will not put up with it for much longer.
All right. Okay, well, on that defiant note, I think I should end this one because I've got the next guest coming up. So this has been a good conversation. There have been a few technical problems, but I think it's gone okay. Gregory Lauder-Frost and Andrew Moffat from Traditional Britain Group, thank you for appearing on Millennial 8.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, excellent. I'll be back soon with Pox Populi. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.